I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Ian. No, we're going to have to interrupt this here because, and I think this will justify the interruption, we have had what I might say, and I don't want to exaggerate too much, but I think this might be literally the best email I have ever received in all of history. And I felt it was worth us reading this out before we even get into who we are and why we're here. Is that permissible?
Of course.
Yeah, good. Because it's going to happen either way. This came in from Steve after last week's episode. And Steve says, "Hello. I must start by saying your podcast is excellent and very informative. It therefore pains me that my first contact with you is to express a minor but massively annoying issue I have. The issue being, ironically, Nate's pronunciation of the word pronunciation. Please note, it is pronunciation, not pronunciation. Sorry, but it's been doing my head in for weeks. Thank you, and cheery regards, Steve."
I've got to say, I love Steve for that, following on from the NVIDIA fiasco.
It's 14 years of penance for me taunting you about how you said NVIDIA once in like 2007.
Yeah.
And I hope, Steve, that in my recital of your wonderful message, that I have correctly pronounced pronunciation on several occasions. I did, didn't I?
Yes, I was listening to it and thinking, yeah, he's doing it right.
Let's proceed. As I was saying, this is Text Message. I'm Nate Langston, and he, the bearded beauty with eyes that sparkle like 1,000 A-bombs, is, so I don't know where that came from, is my co-host, Ian Morris.
Hi.
Hello, Ian.
Hi.
If you're one of our Patreon supporters, this is your extended ad-free version of the show, and thank you to patrons, including Mark Hall, Hangdog, Alex McQuilkin, and Richard Bruce, who are supporting us directly and were at the top of the page when I
Hangdog.
Looked at our
Now, that's
patrons.
A name for a patron.
It's a good name, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, very.
Well, it's been a fun week. That is to say, it's not been a fun week, but we have had some interesting stories to discuss, and we're going to start with this one, because today is Valentine Day, apparently. I forgot. My wife reminded me. Not even kidding. She said, "Didn't you know it was Valentine's Day?" I said, "Oh, yeah, so it is. Happy Valentine's Day." She hadn't got me anything, but then she never does, and neither do I. But some people do. I read on the BBC this week that romance fraud has been on the rise during lockdown. This is the process of scamming someone out of money by pretending to want a relationship. And according to UK Finance, there was a 20% increase in bank transfer fraud linked directly to romance scams in 2020 compared to 2019. And a quick pause here in my script to note that John in the chat says, "Isn't that marriage?" Touché, sir, touché. I continue. The UK's action fraud also said £68 million was lost to such scams in 2020, which in itself was another increase in the previous year. And the BBC said organisations are warning people to be vigilant around Valentine's Day. Now, this intrigued me greatly, and not just over my fear of being caught, over how many times, of course, I've successfully conned you, Ian, into giving me money in return for my affection over our many years of a very close friendship. But it intrigued me because of some of the things that us British are apparently susceptible to doing in return for the promise of hugs and kisses and maybe more. The organisations cited in the BBC story advised the following. Online daters should not send any money, allow the other person to access their bank account, transfer money, or take out a loan on the other person's behalf. Neither should they hand over copies of personal documents, such as their passport or driving license. They shouldn't invest money on the other person's advice, and they should not receive or send parcels on the other person's behalf. Now, A few thoughts come to mind here. Most of them are hilarious. Obviously, it's a very serious problem that people are being scammed out of tens of millions of pounds in the UK alone every single year, and that number is rising. That is obviously the reason we're talking about it. But what intrigued me in particular about these pieces of advice is that they obviously stem from repetitions of people doing those things. I can't think of a very easy way of somebody on a dating service convincing me that for some reason I need to give them access to my bank account or give them a scan of my passport or that I should invest money on their behalf.
Well,
I've seen a lot of these sorts of conversations that can turn sour or turn a bit strange or can involve paying money for, you know, goods and services, which I'm putting in little inverted commas on the webcam here. On a dating site, but not investments.
Well, some of that makes sense, though, if you think about it. Like, it might be possible for someone to say, say if you met someone online and that, you know, it was, you'd had maybe spoken a bit, and they said to you, oh, why don't we pop away for a nice holiday when this is all over? Give me your passport details and I'll book us something nice. You know, you can see that happening, can't you? Like, that's pretty reasonable. And yeah, you know, driving license. Oh, I mean, there must be a reason for that. But you know, you could see how, although it's easy to laugh at, some of them make more sense than others. Like, for example, not sending money, not giving access to your bank account, not transferring money. That's all a bit laughable for it, really, to us. I suspect that it might affect maybe older people, but maybe a bit more. Like, I don't want to say that all older people are not good online, but I guess if anyone's going to be not good online, it might be the older people.
I wasn't going to mention that, but it was in one of the stories that I read when researching this, that people in the 55 to 64 bracket are apparently the most susceptible statistically.
And that's not old. 55 is not old. I mean, as we're rushing towards that sort of age. I mean, yes. A few years, yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Charlotte in our chat said that she has a friend who almost fell for it. They told her friend that their dad was in hospital, that he needed £3,000, and apparently he'd sent her a poem every morning for about 2 months. And this person very much liked this other person. So that's one way. And again, in another story that I saw online, apparently paying medical bills was one of the ways because it appeals to emotion and empathy.
And it's believable, which, at the moment. Like, you know, people might end up needing to go for private because the NHS is overwhelmed. So it would make more sense logically.
But some other things, I mean, investing money on somebody else's behalf, that raises a whole lot of questions because that's not just as easy as firing some money via PayPal or a bank transfer or Western Union or whatever. That's somehow committing to, you know, buying equity in a firm, which
put some Dogecoin in this account for me.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, that would be a funny one, wouldn't it? I'm sure there have been scams involving that have been linked to Valentine's Day with all the recent hoo-ha around Bitcoin and things. But anyway, before, you know, you think that these sorts of scams maybe are only relevant to very small numbers of vulnerable singles or philanderers, apparently in 2019 and 2020, the amount of money lost to romance fraud outstripped the amount stolen by online shopping fraud and outstripped it by millions of pounds, which is just incredible to me. That it is such a huge problem.
People want to be in love, don't they? And sometimes it's harder to fall in love, well, or meet the right person and, you know, I don't know, just find yourself feeling a bit lonely and miserable and enjoying the company of someone who's probably putting quite a lot of effort into making you feel good about yourself, because it wouldn't work any other way, would it? So,
no. I mean, if when Kate and I met many years ago, if on our first date, instead of asking me, would you like some sugar with your coffee, she'd have said, would you please give me £2,000 so I can buy a minority stake in this startup? I would have said, interesting topic, starter. I cover startups. However, no, you may not have my money. I am now going to leave/report you. slash talk about you on a podcast. Instead, the conversation was fine and we got married several years later. but apparently, that's not always the case. So anyway, the lockdown aspect to this is interesting. There was a woman quoted in one of these stories, I think it was the BBC story, by Pauline Smith, who's the head of Action Fraud, who said, "The national lockdowns and other restrictions on our social lives implemented because of the coronavirus outbreak have meant more people have been seeking companionship online, and this has undoubtedly affected the number of reports we have seen." So it's directly tied to, as you say, people, lonely people wanting love, wanting companionship. But I think it's a big shame, and it's something I'm going to be more cognizant of in the months leading up to popular sex holidays in future. I mean, public sex holidays, you know, like Valentine's Day and Hump Day. Isn't that a thing? Something like that.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be Wednesdays or something, isn't it?
Yeah. Is it?
The middle of
every
the week.
Yeah,
Hump Day.
Wow. It's Charlotte in the chat saying Hump Day isn't about sex. I thought it was.
No.
Oh.
It just sounds like it is.
Oh, wow. Well, I've certainly propositioned some people under massive false pretense before now then.
Would you like to enjoy Hump Day with me?
Along those lines, yeah, followed by, can I have access to your bank account? I mean, how the hell else do you think Kate agreed to marry me? You know, who marries podcasters? Seriously, I mean, apart from half of my friends. That was a little self-referential joke there, being a podcaster who is married.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I got it.
So victims of romance scams lose money via bank transfers, sending fraudsters gift cards and vouchers, or gifts like phones and laptops. And as we've said, some people do provide access to their bank accounts or their bank card. So it's a big deal. It's a bigger deal than any of us thought, any of us being Ian and I, and maybe some of you listening. I don't want to appeal to somebody to write in and say something frivolous about whether they've been scammed or whether they have indeed scammed somebody else. But if you do have a personal story on the concept of the romance scam, maybe you have caught somebody in the act of trying to scam you or know someone who has, it'd be very interesting to hear some of your stories, perhaps peppered with some romantic context about how attractive they were and some of the love letters perhaps they sent to you. You can do all of that by sending us an email to uktechshow@icloud.com. The FT wrote this week, amongst many outlets, it must be said, that a UK firm of solicitors that sued a former client for defamation after he left a negative review online has been awarded £25,000 worth of damages by the High Court in London, but was then bombarded with one-star ratings from outraged members of the public. Have you been aware of this, Ian?
I was aware of the original story that he had been fined by for £25,000. I wasn't aware that they'd then be bombarded with one-star reviews.
Yes. So here's a bit of useful background then for anyone who wasn't familiar. The man in question used a law firm called Summerfield Brown online to get some legal advice, but wasn't happy with what he'd received for his £20 or so, and thus left a review on Trustpilot, which is the big reviews aggregator I think everyone's probably aware of, where he accused the firm of being, quote, a scam solicitor, according to court documents, which I read some of this morning, and they're actually quite interesting. The firm wasn't impressed, though, and given its ready access to lawyers, took legal action, stating that this was untrue and defamatory, and that inquiries had gone down, inquiries for new business, that is, with the firm, since the review had been posted. It also said the man hadn't followed its complaints procedure before leaving the comment. So after the court hearing in January, the man was ordered to pay the £25,000 in damages plus costs. But yes, as the FT wrote, the decision has not been well received in the courts of public opinion. But Trustpilot this week had to ban new reviews from being posted on the law firm's review page because dozens of new one-star ratings had appeared from members of the public who'd read news stories about the judgment. There's a couple of quotes here from some of those reviews. One said, "Taking legal actions against your customers will do far more to defame your company than a single negative review." Another one posed the question, "Is all publicity good publicity?" I went to the solicitor's page on Trustpilot this morning to find some fresh examples, obviously found that the reviews had been closed, but also found that Trustpilot had put up a big message right at the very top of the firm's review page, a big blue box, and it says, "We strongly oppose the use of legal action to silence consumers' freedom of speech. As a public open review platform, we believe strongly in consumers having the ability to leave feedback, good or bad, about a business at any time without interference. Unfortunately, we are required to remove the review, which was the subject of the legal action. We are exploring our options to challenge this decision. The business's actions have resulted in media attention, and this profile has seen a significant increase in reviews that don't reflect an experience with the business." The interesting line there, of course, is "we are exploring our options to challenge this decision," being the court decision. Now, Summerfield Brown's overall rating had dropped to 2 stars at the point reviews were closed. But that hasn't, of course, stopped people leaving reviews elsewhere, including Twitter. Before we discuss this a little bit, the law firm said that its decision to pursue legal action was, quote, "not one we took lightly, and doing so gave us no pleasure. However, we could not let lie an ill-founded review of our work, which a judge deemed to be illegal, defamatory, and likely to damage our business and hard-earned reputation." Which I completely believe, frankly, because if you don't defend something, then what are you doing if that's your job? However, there are many ways to go around defending something. And of course, the consumer rights laws in the UK do state that you can demand a refund or a partial refund if you're not happy with the service. Like, that's part of the law. And many people do that. But following official channels is usually expected. And writing angry reviews on a public forum, perhaps before sleeping on it and perhaps before challenging the company in question to intervene and give you some sort of a better refund or outcome, you know, it's maybe ill-advised.
He used the word scam in his original write-up. You can't say something's a scam without being able to back it up with evidence. That is an actionable comment, as far as I'm concerned. Like, you're essentially accusing them of breaking the law. So therefore, yeah, you know, that is defamatory, and you would be well within your rights to sue someone who called you a scammer if you were not one. So in that case, I believe they acted quite properly. Like, whether it was ill-advisable, whether they would have been better off saying to Trustpilot, "Look, this is an actionable comment, take it down," rather than suing him and taking 25,000 quid off him, that's a matter for debate. I think probably it would have been better for them to go to Trustpilot and say that this isn't on. He hasn't sought any sort of refund through us. He hasn't used our adequate complaints procedure. You know, he hasn't gone to the solicitor's ombudsman, whatever that's is, and made a complaint. All he's done is he's gone on the internet and said it's a scam, and it's not. He was just charged money for a service, right? And solicitors are expensive. We've all used them. Well, a lot of us have used them. And it's frustrating, but that doesn't make it a scam. Then the second thing is that Trustpilot's then stupid reply to that, which is, "We strongly oppose legal action to silence consumers' freedom of speech," right? This is not what freedom of speech means. The freedom of speech is not about you being able to say what you want on any platform you want, whenever you want. Freedom of speech prevents the government from stopping you from having the right to free speech. It's a government thing. It's, if you lived in a communist state, you would not be allowed to speak ill of the government or the services provided. You would be thrown in jail or worse. People have got their knickers in a twist about this, and they seem to think that it's the requirement of
free speech that you're able to say whatever you want on privately owned businesses. And that isn't the case. Now, okay, so in this case, Trustpilot seems to side with the guy who called them scammers, which to me says nothing good about Trustpilot, honestly, because if you're trying to build up a legitimate review service of services, then you need people to be honest about that, and you need them to not just resort to claiming one thing because they've got sudden regret because they spent £200. It's absolutely outrageous. And if they're going to use their platform to allow people to do that, which is essentially bullying businesses, then that's just not fair, is it? That's worse than stopping one person from saying one thing once. You know, he would have been perfectly fair to get reasonable. It would have been perfectly reasonable for him to go on there and say, I found this a lot of money to pay for a relatively simple service. I don't feel like it was good value for money. Therefore, one star. You know, that would have been absolutely fine. But he didn't. Instead, he decided to call it a scam. So therefore, they can all get in the bin.
And that's where I was going to suggest might have been a more appropriate course of action, which is, it's a good idea whether you're insulting a business, breaking up with somebody or resigning, to type out an angry email or letter with your fists, then go to bed. And then the next day, reading it, taking out all these, you know, unnecessary hyperbole and threats, and then consider sending it. Because that's usually a way of tempering down anger without removing any of the actual legitimacy of a complaint. That's certainly what I do whenever I want to insult lawyers. And in this instance, it was, as you say, I think ill-advised is a good term for everything on this side. Both it was ill-advised on the part of the person who made the comment. It was ill-advised of the law firm to sue in this instance, or at least this quickly, whether or not they have the right to. And as you say, you know, I mean, they do have the right to, and he has a right to complain online, but the way it's played out isn't really very nice for anybody. So, but it does raise some interesting questions and some interesting comments from our live listeners. Richard said, customers do tend to see through silly comments online, and you can usually tell a paid for comment because of its overwhelming positivity without any critique whatsoever. I never trust 5-star reviews or 1-star reviews. The only reviews I trust are 3 and 4 stars, maybe 2 stars if they've used proper grammar, but usually it's a 3-star and a 4-star that I think are the most believable, because they've taken on board pros and cons. They're not just trying to be angry and vitriolic.
Yeah, but I'm thinking back to when I recently used a mortgage broker who was very, very good, and I could not have got my mortgage without him because of the previously mentioned issue with a weird credit flag. Yes. And I would find it difficult to give him anything but a 5-star review. I don't think there were any downsides. I had to pay for the service. He made some money from selling me a mortgage. You know, he probably did quite well out of it, but he'd also put in the work. So what am I going to do? I would say that's a 5-star product right there.
But I mean, the thing is in the wording of the review, and the, you know, the level of praise to which you go to in order to give that 5-star review. And it's not about discounting 5-star review. It's just that a 5-star review, it's just that my default position is to assume that it's not honest. If it turns out it actually seems honest, then fair, but I assume initially that they're not. But Charlotte, also listening live, said that she manages their company's Glassdoor and asks, can I now sue people who leave shitty reviews? That's a good question.
No.
Someone said the only good thing about their company was that people who work there are sexy. You know,
I mean, that is a good thing to be removed
and said no. Well, whether or not it's a good thing, it's not exactly a nice thing to put.
No, it's not. It's a terrible
thing. On a website.
No, but it's funny. And if they are sexy, then great.
Yeah.
Everyone likes a sexy person. Let's not pretend.
I think in the context of should I work at this company, it's
because
not
because everyone's
top,
sexy.
It shouldn't be top of anybody's list.
No, definitely not. But it's a nice bonus. Great company to work for. Good benefits. Everyone's very sexy. Great. Count me in.
Fair enough.
That reminds me of Flora. I remember we were talking at CNET about, you know, how ridiculously good-looking everyone was in American TV shows and how ridiculously normal everyone is in British TV shows. And she went, yeah, I prefer the American model. I want to look at pretty people, not ugly people. I was like, fair enough.
Fair enough. Have you publicly defamed a law firm? Are you being sued out of spite? Have they got a legitimate reason to sue you?
Don't call us. Call a lawyer.
Yes, exactly. Go and speak to Ian Morris. He'll help you out.
Amateur legal advisor.
Exactly. But whatever your legal position or prison sentence, simply let us know what you think about the whole big fat mess. UKTechShow@iCloud.com. Text message, it's no secret, everyone. It keeps you informed about the British tech landscape. That's no secret. It's been out for ages. For years, it's been out. However, there is another man. His name is Tom Merritt, and he hosts Daily Tech News Show in the US. And if you listen to that show, you hear about the wider things in the world of tech that go on every single week. Every single day, in fact. While this lengthy prelude may just be a thinly veiled attempt at me reloading his promo and adjusting the settings on the mixing desk. But, you know, that's done now. Let's just hear what Tom's been saying.
This week on Daily Tech News Show, we discuss the worldwide chip shortage and how it might be spreading, discuss the announcement of an easy way to make transparent wood, report a scoop about nothing from Nate Langson, that's the phone maker nothing, of course, decide what Hyundai's walking cat-sized car robot is good for, estimate if video games might be the future of movie theaters, and talk about why Microsoft might want all countries to adopt Australia's proposed law that makes Google and Facebook pay for news. All that and much more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Now that was funny. I tend not to listen to Tom's promos before we run them, because I like us to be able to respond to them live. So I didn't know that he was going to mention me. But then also, he didn't know that one of the stories they focused on DTNS this week was a scoop of mine that I'd run on Bloomberg that they just hadn't realized was mine. So they had this whole discussion around the Carl Pei and his company,
his nothing
without realizing it was me that wrote it. For our patrons this week, we had an extra message that went behind the scenes of this show's publication process, which was done in response to a question from one of our patrons. It's very, very, very meta, but it got good feedback. So that's available to most of our patrons now. Thank you to everyone who's been listening live. We have been doing the show not only live, as we do every week, but also on video. That is available to anyone who backs us every month. And you can get those by becoming a patron at patreon.com/UK Tech. And hopefully we will see you and you will see us next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.